Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.
Hello and welcome to another episode of My Property World. I'm Will Mallard and today I'm delighted to be joined by John Paul. Great to have you on the show.
How are you doing, Will? Thanks for having me.
Now, John's going to be telling us about his property, Will. So we're going to go right back to his childhood. But before we do that, John, how would someone get hold of you and what would be the 30-second summary of what you're up to now, which is a number of things?
It's a number of things. So if you want to catch me on my Instagram, it's John Paul Mentor. That's where I'm mostly hang out. So you can catch me on John Paul Mentor.
Well, that's fantastic. And what would be the 30-second summary if you had to list off the hundreds of enterprises you're involved with at this stage?
So we're building an estate agent and letting group. So we've got 11 branches, a couple of thousand houses under management. We'll probably sell about 1,000 houses this year. So we're trying to grow that by acquisition, mostly focusing on the lettings. I've also got a training and coaching business where I focus on teaching people to be better in business using some of the things and the tips and tricks that we implement in our business. I'm also starting a prop tech company, which is going to focus on prospecting software, so outward bound call center software for estate agents and letting agents. And I think that's about 30 seconds. I think I've managed it.
All right. Well done. You're the first person in the history of the podcast to keep to the 30 seconds. So obviously you've got some efficiencies going in the background. So
yes,
it didn't all start there though, did it? So let's go back to John Paul as a four-year-old. Where were you? What was going on in your life at that stage?
Well, I was probably grounded or banned to my bedroom because I was a little bit of a pain in the ass, to be blunt, as a kid. But sort of give you an idea where I come from. I mean, a few people might have heard this story before, but I'm from the County Durham, Northeast England, very much working class and proud. My dad was a miner, granddad was a miner, and his uncles all worked in the mining or the heavy engineering business. And in fact, my children are the first generation in our entire family that's never been down the pit or worked in heavy engineering. So it's a very much a sort of working class background. Again, really, really proud of that. So my dad had worked down the pit for about 5 or 6 years, didn't particularly like it, and I don't blame him. If anyone's been down like a mine or a museum mine, as they call them, it's a horrible place. So he was working for, went to work for a company called ICI, and as a part-time gig, he was welding and making fences and stuff, like metal fences and metal railings. It set up a very small engineering shop and just grew it and grew it and grew it from there. Along, my brother and I come along, and he's got decent-sized business, a couple of million turnover, 40 staff. And he just put me and my brother through a good education. We went to private school. You know, we had the holidays. We did all sorts. Not wealthy, definitely not rich, but lived in a good neighbourhood, loving parents, didn't have the traditional backstory where they were arguing or they split up, had amazing parents. No problems there. I come from a good family as well, even though they were working class. Nobody was in trouble with the police. It was just a nice, nice place to be.
And where in Durham were you?
So I was born in a little place called Trimden, which is where, not to get political, but it was where Tony Blair was. So he was in the little mining village of Trimden. And we moved around a little bit. Parents moved to Richmond in North Yorkshire. That was a nice place. We went to Darlington for a couple of years. And then we settled in Peterlee when I was about 11, 12. And I lived there for about the next 16, 17 years, either with my parents or when I got my own home. And it's actually only the last probably 15 years split quite equally, like 8 years where I was in Easington, which is where Billy Elliot was filmed. If anybody's seen Billy Elliot before, literally dancing on the little outside toilet roofs. And then I've moved.
Prime ministers and movie stars and things.
Well, just for the listeners and viewers, I never met him, and I never met Billy Elliot. So it's you know, they're not exactly top of my list. And then the last 8 years I've been living, probably only about 20 miles away in a little village called Red Marshall near Stockton. But yeah, I had a really good childhood. Dad sent us to like good school. Wasn't a particularly academic child, if I'm honest. I struggled at GCSEs. I shouldn't have done my A-levels, but I begged my parents to let me stop at the school to do my A-levels. And the truth was, I was just interested in cricket, like cricket and rugby. I live for sport. I just wanted to be a sportsman. I don't think we mentioned New Zealand in the cricket, do we? So
if someone's listening at some point in the future, England has bet New Zealand 3-0 in a test series. New Zealand being the current world test champions. And I believe England has both a New Zealand-born coach and a New Zealand-born captain. So we can take a small element of pride.
Well, if you can't beat them, join them. That's what we always say. So we've dragged them across. But so
I saw one of the stats in the series in the history of the England cricket test team. They've only had a successful fourth innings run chase of over 220 twice, and there's been three in this one series, which is some going.
Yeah, it just shows you when you get a new leadership and a new impetus and a new direction what it means to the team.
Yeah, they've always had the talent as an outsider looking in, but they seem to have managed to get out of their own way in this series. So, for sure.
I was always cricket daft. I loved it.
Were you a batter or a bowler?
I was a bit of an all-rounder when I first got into it. So I was probably about 5-6 and like a first change swing bowler. In the covers, I used to like diving around a bit. But then I found weightlifting and bodybuilding and started to pile on a bit of beef. And you know, that took over my life. I was eating. It was all about, you know, getting the calories in, getting the protein. And, you know, was at college as well. So I was part-time training there, you know, doing a HND college course, but also.
And what was that in? So what did you, what was at age 14, what was the game plan other than going to the gym?
Well, the game plan at 14, 15 was I wanted to be a professional sportsman. So that's what it, and GCSEs and then A-levels were completely secondary. So it was like sport. I used to cram in my revision last minute, fail most of it, but maybe scrape through on just enough not to get sent through to detention. I was a good kid. I knew what was right from wrong. I didn't like confrontation. And I actually got bullied quite a bit when I was about 13, 14, because of the way I spoke, considering the school I went to. So I went to quite a well-to-do school, and we had a lot of like famous kids, sons and daughters there and whatnot. And it was a very posh, well-known school. And I didn't speak like those. I was a day pupil as well. So those guys were, I was in a boarding school. So where those guys after, you know, when you finish school, were making sort of relationships and getting to know each other and connections. I was going home to my friends back in Peterlee where I lived. So coming back the next day, I wasn't part of the gang. I wasn't in with the in jokes and stuff. So long story short, I hated it for about 2 or 3 years. And I started to get bullied quite heavily, which is a big, big, big surprise if anybody knows me or met me, because I'm not exactly a small fella. So, and where this leads to with my background in martial arts and stuff. But I think it's the same as everything else, is the reason I got started in martial arts and hit the gym and stuff was because I got bullied. I mean, I got, you know, it sounds really weird, but my foot set alight. They poured lighter fluid on my foot when I was in a class and set my foot alight. They'd ransack my locker. One guy he was never going to stab us, but he pulled a penknife on us, you know, and then the mental torture and bullying. But I never, ever, ever mentally let them beat me. I always, always, always stood up for myself, even if they ridiculed me. So I knew I was mentally tough, even from an early age. And my dad was always like, turn the other cheek, big man, you know, the bigger man walks away, which I've since found out was a load of crap. But at the time, when your dad's telling you, you know, now it's listen, I'm not condoning violence, but everyone's got to snap at a breaking point. So, you know, how you parent your kids and whatnot is totally up to you. But, you know, me, I don't mind telling you, I'll say to Jack, hit first, hit fast, hit him on the nose, and then tell the teacher you're sorry. So, you know, if your kid hits my kid, you know, that's it. But yeah, so I started, my dad took me down to, I said, I want to go boxing. So it was back in the day where you had, in the local supermarket, you had the cards for boxing clubs or knitting clubs or crochet clubs or whatever clubs there were. And my dad never had his glasses on and he saw the word boxing. It was actually Thai boxing, which is, you know, kicking knee and elbow and like, you know, or throwing and stuff as well as punching. So I turned up here with my boxing gloves at 15, 16 year old, 15 I was, and they literally kicked the crap out of me for 3 months, like kicking and deadening my legs and stuff. And then I had to walk home. It was just under a mile away. And sometimes it took me an hour to walk home because my legs were beat up. I had to stop every 200-300 yards, just rest my legs. But I stuck at it. I've got quite a stubborn streak. So I stuck at it. And then I just loved it and then got into it. Didn't tell anybody at school I was doing this for fear of not being very good. And then some of the older kids try it out and just kick the living crap out of me and not work. So I kept it quiet for about 2 years till I was 16 and a half. But then we had a good 6-7 weeks off for summer holidays. That's when I hit the gym. We used to get 8 weeks being a private school. So we stayed at school a bit longer than your average comp. Mm-hmm. But we got longer off. So it was 8 weeks. And I'd literally in the 8 weeks put about nearly a stone on, which isn't a lot. But when you're 16, that's a lot of beef. That's a lot of muscle. And a bit of a belly as well. But I was also training Thai boxing. So I came back and as luck would have it, somebody just took the mick out of me. I stood up for myself, didn't turn out too well for him. And then all of a sudden I just got left alone. So literally when I came back from 16 and a half year old, everyone, even the year above me lads, just leave JP alone, just, you know, let him get on with it. And then
in a moment, like how people viewed you changed, but it was on the back of 2 years of hard work.
It was probably 2 years of hard work, three and a half years of getting bullied since I was just gone 13. So it was, I put up with for a good year and a half, 2 years of just putting up with the bullying, the constant torture and whatnot. And then when I started doing the Thai boxing, training twice a week, it was a Monday and a Wednesday, and then hitting the gym only 3 days a week. It's not like I was proper bodybuilding, but just getting.
And how did it feel at that point? Like you pushed back for the first time.
Oh, I'm not going to lie. I felt $1 million. Like, felt absolutely brilliant, and a big sigh of relief came across. Now the chap that had bullied me, I became good friends with him, really good friends with him, and he wasn't the head bully or he wasn't a nasty kid. He was just quite impressionable, and the bullies were bullying him to get onto my case. So Richard, I won't say his surname, but Richard had sort of bullied me. Like I said, whatever happened. And then after that, even the bully sort of left us alone. And there was a couple of times when I got 17, which is like your sixth form, on a night out, you know, I had a couple of quiet words with the bullies and sort of said, listen, you know, that happens again. There's going to be repercussions. It's up to you. In not as polite as that, and they just, oh John, you know, kids will be kids, just leave us alone, blah blah blah. And it felt great. Well, I'm not gonna lie, all this, you know, be nice to be nice and stuff, you've got to stick up for yourself, and it felt bloody good.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what was happening on the back of this better feeling about yourself and about the world, what were you planning on doing? We said at 13-14, What were your thoughts sort of at 16, 17?
Yeah, I still wanted to play professional sport. It was sort of swaying towards being a professional fighter, maybe Thai boxing or something else. But it was always sport. Even when I was definitely not academic, and I remember my house tutor or teacher said to my parents, don't let him do a degree. He's just not cut out for a degree. So when I chose my A-levels, which was history, ancient history and geography, and I dropped geography because I was just failing it miserably. I got just enough grades to get into college to do effectively like a half a degree, like a HND, which in personal management, which I've never used since. So it was a waste of time, but it was just something to get you into that way of thinking, that critical analysis, that way of thinking. But it was always going to be, even then it was sport. There was a little bit of a sort of fly in the ointment that why I couldn't go professional. My brother was diagnosed with a kidney disease at 15, 16. And we always knew I was going to...
This is your younger or older brother?
Younger, Jamie. So he's a year younger than me. So he had a kidney disease called nephritis. We thought he was... He was anemic because he was pale all the time and quite weak. So we thought was lack of iron. Turns out his kidneys were not performing. So one was about 3/4 kaput and the other one was about 1/2 kaput. But the hospital said, we're just going to get, he's only 15, 16. We're going to get as much out of him as we can. So my mum had just had beaten cancer. My dad was 50 odd, like early 50s. And he was a heavy smoker. So they said, you're not a suitable match. So I went and got tested and I was like an absolute perfect match, better than average. So we always knew something. At one point I was just going to get a call and I was going to have to give him my kidney. So I was told to be careful. However, I had I'd had a couple of professional Thai boxing fights. Mm-hmm. It's 17, 18 and 19. I'd had about three or four. So, but I couldn't really chuck myself into it. I could dabble, but I couldn't really go for it. Mm-hmm. And then I think I was 23, 24. They basically said, right, your brother's levels are really low now. I was like, great, yeah, cool. When we're going to do it? And they just went 3 weeks. So, like, oh, wow. So 3 weeks went by and went and just gave him my kidney.
Right. And that's a big responsibility for someone, like you're, and I suppose you had a bit of a mental period to prepare for that over the 6 or 7 years in between.
Well, yeah. So you've got to go get you've got to go speak to a psychologist, like the hospital provides, just to make sure you're mentally okay to do it. And I remember the guy saying, is this an act? And I was very upfront and saying, no, it's not an act. He says, because you're incredibly blasé about this. What you're doing is a huge, huge, big thing. I remember saying to him, how many do I need to live? And he went, well, you only need one. I went, so I've got a spare. And he went, it doesn't quite work like that. But technically, I went, well, listen, if I only need one and he needs one, I'll give him mine. I don't know what the big issue is. But I've always been like that. I've always been like, if there's a problem, I'm sure there's a solution. And mm-hmm. we'll work through it. It might not be the ideal situation, but if there's a solution, we'll just work through it.
From your point of view, there was no choice really in terms of the options, professional sport or your brother.
Well, I kept saying to the guys, like, will this hamper me? And he said, it'll put you back. And in my head, it was a setback. It wasn't saying you can't do it. It was a setback. But at the time I was doing a lot of Thai boxing. I was weightlifting like hell. I was about 18 and a half stone, just really, really solid. So I knew it was going to be some sort of martial arts or some sort of combat sports. So when this happened, and I lost about 2 stone in the next 6-7 months just because I couldn't train. And I went, for me, it was like skinny. I didn't like it. I just knew it was a setback. I knew it wasn't the end of the world. Jamie was fine. He was going to live fully. It didn't reject the kidney. So we knew that. So it was like, well, it's a year out of your life. It's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what else was happening in between in that sort of 16 to 24 time frame? What were you up to?
Not a lot. Well, obviously, when you're 18, 19 and you're going out and you're young, free, daft and single, you're just trying to, go out and enjoy yourself. So I was doing a lot of that. Wasn't sticking in, wasn't academic. I'd gone and got myself a job.
Roughly, what year would this be at this stage?
Blumenek, early, late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So at this stage, the
back end of the mining industry was pretty much done and dusted.
That was the 80s. So that was the late 80s. Yeah.
It was quite a tough time, within that whole northeast region, as a wider. Huge swathes of Yorkshire, the economy just totally changed. Unemployment would have been very high, and what would have been like an established pathway for employment and for being in business, it totally changed over those years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it really, if it wasn't just the miners, it was all the like the sort of ancillary companies that were affected. Mm-hmm. So my dad at the time had the engineering business, precision engineering. He had a mining business as well with a business partner, Purdy Mining. And that went bust overnight because when more of the pits were shut, 100% of his work was with the NCB, National Coal Board. And I remember we were getting ready to go on holiday. We'd just go to Scotland and my dad was running around. I can't remember. I think I was like 11 or something, 12. And the National Coal Board had said, basically, some of the pits that you do work for have been shut down or they're not taking any more orders. And my dad was running around trying to, what they had said was, whatever invoices you can get to us in the next 7 days, we will honour. So my dad was going around speaking to all the guys and saying, look, let's get 3 or 4 shifts on for the next 7 days, invoice them. To the guys, he was saying, you'll get like a month's worth of income for a week. And, you know, you can go out and do whatever. So that's, I remember that. And then literally after 7 days, he handed the keys back to the landlord. That was it. The business was shut down. So having your eggs in one basket was something that I didn't really understand at the time. But as a business consequence, when I went on my own, I was like, right, I definitely don't want to be in that situation again. Mm-hmm. So that was a good learn point, teachable moment, as they say. And then from then on, it was just working for my dad. So I was health and safety and quality assurance for him. So I was really hated because basically I had to tell them that the quality wasn't up to scratch. And then I had to get on the cases for not wearing the glasses or some of them used to take the guards off the machines to try and get easy access. And I'd be going around and saying, you can't do that. So, and I was the boss's son, so nobody liked me.
So, and that whole, like what was also going on was like quality standards and, that things that were but perhaps sort of skipped over a little bit in previous generations became sort of like how you do it, and you had to be compliant, and not everyone necessarily agreed with that as a concept.
Yeah, well, I mean, even now in our business, the estate agency, things like the audit and you know, quite a lot of the procedures very, very similar to what I was doing back in the day 20 years ago, because it worked. Like we even used to call it non-conformance. Like if something went wrong and it didn't conform, it's called that now. So we call them NCRs, non-conformance reports. So if anything goes wrong in our business and we audit it, then you know it's virtually the same forms with a little bit of tweaks. Mm-hmm. So I picked that up and ran with that with my business. But at the time, and this is where it gets a little bit dicey, was you know, I was about 24, 25. We'd given the kidney thing away. That had been done about a year and a half, something along those lines. And I was 25 and I was playing rugby and I was doing quite well. I played senior county level. I, you know, decent teams after us, but I didn't want to leave my team that I played for so long. I'd basically played since I was a kid, you know, under 11s and 12s. So I remember we played a game. I think it was one of the games we needed to win the league or something. My dad said, can you come round? I want to chat to you. And I says, oh, Dad, we've just won the league. And can I come round in the morning? I'll be hungover, but can I come round? He says, yeah, son, don't worry. Your brother's going to be there. So got me and my brother there. Bear in mind, I'm 24, he's 23, whatever. And he sat me down in the kitchen, him and my mum, and he basically said, I've got cancer. And we were like, oh, you're going to be fine. Don't worry. Mum's beat it once. You're going to be fine. He said, no, he says, I'm not. He says, I've been given 6 months to a year to live. And obviously, you know, it absolutely destroys you. He says, I've got quite a bit in my liver. It's going on. It's secondary cancer. So he said, we've got 6 months to a year. Don't worry. We're going to get the best treatments, blah, blah, blah. Try and prolong it a bit. But I'm going to fire sale the business. So he tried to sell it a couple of years earlier. And they'd literally not come to a deal over something so little. Like it was tiny, but it was a substantial sum of money. So he said, I'm going to go back to the guy. I'm going to knock 20% off and he should buy it, right? I'll just agree. We'll get it sold. Set your mum up for life. Set you and your brother up for a good start in life. So that was on the Sunday. So I only lived about a mile away. I got a phone call about 2 weeks later saying, off my mum, hysterical, saying, it's your dad. So I drove up and he was a shell. I hadn't seen him for 3 or 4 days and it looked as though he'd lost about, he wasn't a big guy. He was only 5'10", 11 and a half, 12 stone, but he looked about 8 stone. He just lost a ton of weight. And, you know, he slipped into a coma. He got blue lighted. He slipped into a coma and he died 2 days later. And what had happened is when they took the biopsy to see exactly how long he had left, he got an infection through that. So it was actually pneumonia that killed him, not the cat, is often the case, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. So it was devastated. I mean, thankfully he woke up a little bit and I got to say a few things to him and he understood and whatnot, which was great. But to top it off, because he was integral to the business, 3 months later, the business went bust and we lost the whole lot, the family. So I was employed by the business. My brother was, my mum was, we had company cars, the whole lot. And then the receivers came in and just, I was the first one to be made redundant. My brother was the second, my mum was the third. And I don't blame them because they were just doing a job, but it just, you know, you lose your dad. And then 3 months later, you lose the company business that had been in the family for 25, 30 years, and your entire family, your immediate family, lose all their income. So my mum had a few little bits and bobs savings and insurances, but me and my brother didn't get anything. Like, you know, what wasn't asking for anything, but, you know, that sort of situation was just horrible. So, it was a tough couple of times, a couple of years with the kidney thing, lost a couple of grandparents. My mum had cancer. Had, you know, a couple of operations. My dad had died. We lost the business all in about 4 or 5 years. So it was a little bit of a crappy 4 or 5 years, to be honest. But being mentally quite strong from a young age, I think that has definitely propelled me to be where I am. And I know we touched on it before about being mentally tough. I massively think that has hugely helped me in growing to where I am today.
And tell me, what was the what was your immediate kind of reaction when you got laid off by the receivers?
I was angry, really angry, because I was a bit immature and I didn't understand it. And I had a company car and I refused to give it back. So basically, I got pulled over in North Allerton. Funnily enough, I've got an estate agency in North Allerton now. It's funny how it goes 360, isn't it? I go down there quite a lot, but I got pulled over and there was a policeman and he was lovely and he understood once I explained it. And he basically said, well, I can't let you get the car, but what I will do is I'll give you a lift. So the car got towed away. I had to go back actually because I had some stuff in it. Something was like personal to me from my dad, which, you know, I used to carry around. It's only a daft little rugby ball that he had. And then he gave me a lift. So I was really angry. I was bitter. A good couple of weeks later, I sort of started to chill out and understand it. But then I just had to realize, what was I going to do with my life? And one thing my dad was big on was, even though I wasn't very good at it, was education and courses and stuff. He was quite old school in that thinking. So I did my health and safety courses, a couple of them anyway, and I did a couple of quality courses, internal quality auditing. And I went to work for a foundry, a health and safety and quality. So again, I was hated again because I had to tell people that your work's crap. And by the way, can you wear your glasses? So that's effectively what I had to do. I liked it. The guy was good. I worked for Jennings Winch and Foundry in Sunderland. It was a nice guy. My immediate manager was great, treated me really well. I learned a lot from him, but it just wasn't for me. So I was clearing out my garage and I saw a business plan of my dad and I when he was just before he was poorly. So when he was going to sell it previously, and it was effectively, it was a couple of pages, but it was like sell business, buy houses. That's it. It was like, there was nothing complicated. And so I said, oh, this has got a bit of it. I'll review this. And this was 2005, 2006, 2007, something like that. Mm-hmm. Four, five, six. So I just started to buy houses. I remortgaged my house. I remember the first house I bought, I got a NatWest mortgage, 15% down. It was only 25 grand house, which is crazy. And I bought four or five. I bought three, waited 6 months, remortgaged them, got my money out, bought more. And this wasn't clever investing. This was the time that you could have bought a post box, waited a year and doubled your money. So this wasn't me being clever. This was just...
I think in those days, if you could walk and chew gum, you could be a property investor.
Yeah, exactly. And for some people, even that was difficult.
I've got a mate who bought a couple of places around there for 20,000, maybe 2002. They were worth 80,000 by 2007-8, and they went back down to 40,000. But he cashed out at 80,000. So
he's doing well. Yeah. I mean, some of mine I bought in 2007, just before the crash. probably what only worth now what they what I bought them for. Because they were overinflated, because you're getting a lot of Irish, a lot of London investors who were paying like, you know, 50, 60,000 quid for a house that was probably only worth like 45 grand or whatever. So I bought a few, got my portfolio, and I was doing a lot of martial arts then, a lot. I was competing. And I was going
in the Thai boxing still?
No, I'd progressed actually. So I'd gone to cage fighting, basically. So I was doing a lot of jiu-jitsu, Greco-Roman wrestling, freestyle wrestling, training with a lot of guys over here and going to America to train and fight.
So the cage fighting, you've got to be good at like several disciplines that are completely different.
Yeah, so you'll always have a dominant one. So mine was the Thai boxing, which later swapped to wrestling, like American wrestling, like Greco-Roman wrestling. It was more freestyle, not Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage. So if anyone's listening, don't imagine me in like a yellow top tearing it apart. It's nothing to do with that.
With a bandana.
yeah, talking about my pythons and guns and all that. No, so I was tired. It was more Thai boxing, training, fighting, loved it. But my properties were going to help pay for me to go to America and train and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And it just grew. I mean, I loved it. I mean, I'd had a good couple of fights. You know, done quite well at that. Was loving it. I had a couple of pro fights. I think I had four pro fights at the time. I'd won all those. And then my daughter was born and I just wanted to spend more time with her. So, I mean, I was going to America for a month at a time. So it was quite a big commitment, training with like UFC champions and world champions and whatnot, and loved it. But, you know, I was never going to make a living out of it, or a good living. I was never going to make enough to support my family.
It's not something you could do for 30 years, I imagine.
Yeah, it's very, very rare. I mean, there's a guy now I train with a couple of times called Michael Bisping, who's retired to about 2-3 years ago. And he was middleweight world champion, and he's a lovely guy. I went down to Leicester when he was living there, and he came up to the Northeast to train. We got on really well. And we were about the same size, similar skill set. He was a bit fitter than me, but I was a bit stronger than him, so it sort of worked its way out. And I decided that it was going to be family first, and that's just the way I am. He decided it was going to be his fighting first, but it's paid off for him. So he was the world champion, and, you know, his family's moved over there from Clitheroe to America, and it's worked out for him, but I didn't want to take that risk.
Mm-hmm. And take me back to like the start of the property side of things. So you what was your plan? Was it to buy and keep the rental income? Was it to did you hold on to everything? Did you sell anything? What was the...
I've got most of the ones I've ever had. I mean, the plan was just to buy, refurbish, remortgage, rent out the normal BRM model. And the income that I was going to do, it was because I was still working part-time. I was doing nightclub bouncing. I was doing a bit of debt collecting. I was doing teaching martial arts as well. So I was doing all the stuff that could get you hurt, basically, for not a lot of money. So I wanted the properties to sort of supplement that income, so I could actually get rid of some of the crap jobs and then just concentrate on the training. And it was 2008 that local housing allowance changed from housing benefit to local housing allowance, where you know, the world fell off a cliff, obviously, because of the recession. But people were getting paid. The tenants were getting paid direct. So there's a lot of local landlords were absolutely up in arms because some of the tenants were doing runners with the money. And it happened to me, and there was one of my tenants ran off for 2 months' rent. So I went to the council, asked why this had happened, and they explained it had changed from housing benefit to local housing allowance. And it wasn't just a ticky box exercise now. You had to have reasons. And says, great, who did you learn off? I went, oh, my supervisor. So I says, can I speak to them? Spoke to the supervisor. And eventually I just kept going up the chain, till I got to speak to the head of housing for the then district council. He was a lovely guy, Paul, and we sat down and he just told me about the regulations. I said, great, how do you know about them? He says, oh, we get like a circular from DWP. I went, great, how do I get on the list? He says, oh, it's free. Just go on the website, you can download it. Surprised the hell out of me that this stuff was free. So I learned the legislation, and it got to a point where I was getting paid inside 28 days. They weren't coming after me for overpay. And I was effectively challenging the council, but also helping the council as well, like advising some of the individuals about things. They just started putting landlords my way. They just started saying, you want to go speak to John? And before I know it, they were asking me to manage their properties. So I set up a letting agency, effectively, just to manage my house.
And that space, the rent collection is like a huge portion of what the business is. And if you've got that, you know, under control, you've got a system, you understand how it fits in, it's a massive advantage.
Huge. And I was sourcing a bit of property as well. So I employed somebody who came from another sourcing background, and coupled with the landlords, I wouldn't say a throwing, but they were giving us like fives and 10 houses and stuff. And then my first employee, Lisa, she was sourcing houses maybe a couple of months. We quickly grew in the first like 12, 13 months. I think we had something like 180 houses under management. And it started to get a bit serious then. I employed staff. The idea was I was still going to go away and train and fight and whatnot. But it just got so serious that I just had to sort of retire from the martial arts. Still train, still taught people, but I couldn't compete because I couldn't have the time to devote to it. And then just decided to really get into, throw myself into business and understand about how business runs and operates and finances. And tell me,
do you remember when you decided that's what you're going to do?
I did. And there was two parts to this. So deciding that I was going to do it just so I could receive the income to allow me to fight and train was one. And then it was about 3 years after that when I said, I'm just playing at this. We were losing landlords, we're gaining landlords, we're losing staff, but we're recruiting again. And I realized that if I was going to make a job out of it, like a business out of it. So my definition of a business is probably a lot different to a lot of other people. So I think if you can't go on a desert island for 3 months and have not take your phone or your emails or not get any messages to and from you at the island to your business, if you can do that and it runs really well or better without you, that's a business. If you can't, you're just self-employed. And there's nothing wrong with being self-employed. Absolutely nothing wrong whatsoever. It's just when people say my business, I understand it's just a label people put on them. But like a gas engineer that goes and does the CP, the gas safeties, or a sparky that goes and does rewire houses, a business, in my opinion, is not how much you turn over or how much profit you make, or even how many staff you employ or how long you've been in business. A business can run and operate without you. It should run the same, if not better. Self-employed or being self-employed is where you were, it's reliant on you. And it was about the 3 year mark. I said, I've just got a job here. I'm just self-employed. Thinking back to what happened to my dad. So that's when the big mindset shift of I need to create a business that can operate without me and surround myself with people who are better than me came. And then I sort of muddled along for the next two or three years. We bought a business. So this would be about 2012, 13, something like that, maybe 14 at a push. And we'd had about three branches then. And it was really, you think going from one branch to two branches is tough. Going from two to three is even tougher if you're in the business. So I quickly had to work out management and leadership.
And what was the drive time from the furthest to the furthest?
It wasn't too far, actually. So I lived in Easington at the time, and we had one in Easington. We bought one in Seaham, which is about 4 miles away. But the Bishop Auckland one was probably, that was the longest. That was about 25 minutes away in a car. And I was doing a lot of traveling to there to get that up off the ground. Had a couple of bad hires that didn't work out well, and then it was just like, right, we're gonna start running it like a business. And that was when the light switch came on, and it was all about like training development. I was very fortunate actually that the first business I bought, which was the basis of the second branch, came with a lady called Adele, who is my MD now, and she runs the business for me. And she was and is exceptional. And we just clicked straight away, and she just runs it. She's got a real passion for coaching and for people, which is I don't. So I'm not a manager. I'm more of a leader and an entrepreneur and a driver. Adele is leader. She's good at that, but she's definitely more management and more. So her training, development, coaching ability is probably the best I've ever seen. It's phenomenal. She cares. She really does care. So she started to run that. We'd sort of meet up and talk pretty much on a daily basis, but she sort of ran it. And that I could concentrate on other aspects of business as well.
And so you've got a bit of a portfolio going at this stage. You've got you're at three branches,
Yes.
and that 2 to 3 is the big step in your mind.
It was, yeah. And then so that's why not a lot of people in, I think there's more independence in the UK with one branch than any other sort of demographic. Obviously, you've got the ones with.
I think this is true in all sorts of. I think the average, what is it? 1.9 properties is the average
Is it
for a landlord.
really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
I've got people
nobody wants
stuck
to
at a
deal with
particular point. Yeah.
a lot of tenants. I mean, it's a lot of potential communication points and trouble, isn't it? So yeah, we got to three, and then I think that's when I made a conscious decision to try and grow it, to really grow the business. And then we just, so that was 2014, 15. I think we bought one in 15, one in 16. I think we had another one in 17, but we shut it down. So we've had a couple of branches that we've closed down. So I've got no problem with trying something, planning out as best you can, but it not working. I've got absolutely no problem with that. I'll own that as
And
well.
what would you say makes the difference most often?
To where it success or failure for people, 100% it's the people. Location's important, but with everything being so remote now, it's more the people. You could have quite a remote business with amazing people and it would work. But you could have a city centre business with crap people and it won't work. So everybody talks to me about systems and thinks I'm big on systems. I'm more on having the best people or the best team.
Well, the systems allow good people to be great performance like you are.
Well, the thing as well, Will, is good people will write good systems, but if you've got bad systems, even great people will follow it. If they follow it, they'll be wrong. So if you the better the person, they will adapt and improve the systems for you.
Now, we'll keep talking a little bit more, but a little plug for John Paul. You can check out his some of his posts on it. Virtually any social media channel. He suggested on Instagram, but I've seen him in all sorts of other places. Lots of really good practical business ideas, tips for agents, tips for property people, and I think it's mainly common sense stuff that you can't argue with, really.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the things. I'm not that clever, so I mean, having said that, I've done a couple of more sort of courses and degrees and stuff. But I like to keep things basic and simple, and I think we overcomplicate business and life in general. And I think if you're just balanced and you keep emotion out of it, and you're very much logical, and you don't say, "What should I do about this tenant and this in arrears and that in arrears?" Right? Well, let's take the logic out of it. Sorry, the emotion. Legally, what can you do? Morally and ethically, what can you do? Right, so we're not going to send the lads around. That's one thing. You're not going to go and put your own windows out. Right, what can you do? Let's have a sensible conversation with the tenant. Let's speak to the guarantor. It's those types of things that I think gets a lot lost with. It's emotional intelligence. Well, people let emotion get the better of them, and they don't like look at themselves, and they don't critically analyze what they're seeing and what they're doing. And I think it's just common sense is not that common, really.
Well said. And so talk us through the sort of next stages. So you got to three, you've got the superstar manager. It sounds like a turbo boost for your progress, really.
It was, and I could have stopped there, and she could have run it, and I could have done, I was buying a few houses a couple of year by then. I was up at like 30 or something of my own. And it was great. And I just said, I've always been a bit of an empire. I mean, empire is a strong word, but I've always wanted a big business that ran without me, that at some point in the future I could sell it and have what I call a life-changing capital event where you can cash your chips in. Because a lot of people think, oh, you're a landlord, you must be rich. No, not really. Or you've got a business, you must be rich. Definitely not. But where it comes is the hard graft. It's sort of very, very much delayed gratification. You should get the money if it's run well at the end. Don't get me wrong, I've got quite a few houses now, and they do very well. Thank you very much. And my coaching business does very well. But it's where you build the business up and you sell it. That's when you get that hard work comes to fruition. So it was a case of growing the business. So we were acquiring a couple of businesses, doing quite well. Had a business partner that didn't work out. I bought him back. Had a couple of failed branches. We've had two, I believe. haven't worked out well. The latest one was last year, actually. We shut one last year, which again, I'll own that. I've got no problem whatsoever. It would have been even worse business to keep it going and lose money. Because we started it literally 3 months before the pandemic. Not my finest hour. We didn't know that. So we hadn't had the 10, 15 years worth of people knowing who we were and whatnot.
And there's a big difference shutting down one branch when you've got 10 or 11 than shutting down one branch when you've got one or two.
Exactly. And it was a crap decision. And I remember speaking to my business partner about it, and he's a lot more experienced and wiser and older than me. And it was just common sense stuff. So, it was a crap night's sleep for me. But then the next morning I woke up and it was like, do you know what? It's absolutely the right thing to do. You know, nobody lost their jobs. The landlord had quite a lot of money spent on an old gym that we turned into a lovely office. And we left some stuff in there from the desks and stuff so we could rent it out. So nobody lost out, and we did it the right way. And we redeployed one. We only had two staff. One decided to put his notice in, and that was the catalyst. And then we just redeployed the other one. So it was done the right way. But listen, it's easy to criticize people when you're not doing it yourself, but it's actually getting in there and trying it. And what's the saying? It's easy to criticize people sitting up for running when you're lying on the couch or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So just talk me through a little bit to the transition from three to, up to 10 or so branches.
Yeah.
What were the catalysts? Where were you getting your, game plans? You mentioned you were getting, you went and did some other education. Were there any key people that you met, and what were the light bulb moments in the midst of all the grind?
Yeah, so I'm a huge, huge avid reader, and I love watching, listening to podcasts and watching YouTube. You can sort of see all my books there, and I've got about 600-700 at work. And I just read and love hearing about people acquiring businesses and growing business, and came up with my own kind of module of business, of the 9 modules that if you do them very well, you'll have a successful business. And I think it was about 2016, 17, a friend of mine sort of said, do you want to start a property education company? So we did. And he'd worked for quite a well-known property education company for two guys. And Rob, my friend, they'd sort of said, we'll set this up. You teach letting agents and I'll teach property investors. And we had a successful business. It made good profits, helped a lot of people. But then after about 18 months, Rob came to me and he had a lot going on in terms of his other businesses. And he said, I've got to concentrate on other things. And I didn't want to take it on. So we naturally just wound the business down. Again, did it the ethical and right way. And nobody, well, it was very profitable. There was no need to, we just stopped taking orders on. We had no debt. We stopped the masterminds and whatnot. But I really enjoyed that. That was my first part of the coaching. And I really enjoyed coaching because we had 6 or 7 branches then. In fact, we had 5 or 6. That was right. Because we had 6 up until about 2019, and we've virtually doubled in size since then as we've got momentum. So I set up a company of my own, just coaching and training estate agents and letting agents. So, and that's been going since mid 2018. So that's what I do 2 days a week. And then the other 3 days a week, look for acquisitions. So we've got two acquisitions going through at the minute for letting agents. We've just taken on a franchise or the Territory for Fine and Country, which is the high end estate agency. So work on that a bit. And then the other stuff is pretty much writing content.
And geographically, what's the spread?
It's actually quite a big spread. It probably, if you draw from the most northerly to the most southerly, probably about an hour and a half. So Hexham and Prudder, which is in Northumberland and Alston. And then we've got about 6 or 7 in County Durham. And then we've got a couple in North Yorkshire in Thirsk and North Allerton, which are lovely little market villages. Mm-hmm. So that one, and this might be quite interesting. We keep the brand names. So we've got the ones up in Northumberland are called Red Hot. It's a terrible name for a business, but you know, it was already called that, so we had to keep it. Well, we didn't have to, but we kept it because our core brand, what I start, was called Castledane, but nobody knew who Castledane was up there, so we kept that. We've got four Castledanes. We've got a Hegarty's, which is in Houghtonry Spring. We kept that. We've got a Gordon Lamb in Washington. We kept that. We've got Fine and Country, which is across North Yorkshire. And we've got James Wynn, which we bought in Thurskin, North Allerton. So we've got the Castledane group and then the various brand names underneath, which is interesting. And not a lot of people do that. They always change it to...
It always ends up taking longer and being confusing and not really being that great usually.
Exactly. And we just thought it's a risk to change it. It's not a risk to keep it the way it is. Mm-hmm. Not saying it's off the cards, but you know, now we've got like the 11 branches and 50 odd staff. It's a serious, decent sized business now. So we've got a board now, me and my business partners on it. We've got an FD, a commercial director, my MD's on it. And we've taken the tack now, instead of buying estate agents, we're just purely concentrating on, we've got enough spread and enough going on to grow the sales side. We want to concentrate on bolting on little letting agency acquisitions to therefore just bolster that residual monthly income. So as and when there will be a recession, because there is going to be one, we just don't know when. That will just sort of keep us through going through the tougher times.
And how important do you think the confidence in yourself and the model and the thinking behind it to your success?
I think it's definitely a team effort, but I think it's massively important to have somebody who is seen as a leader in the business, and you know, ideas have to come from someone, but they're just tweaked and improved by a team. So, you know, I don't think the rest of the board would disagree with this, that you know, I bring the acquisitions to the table and pretty much most of the income generating ideas. And then the rest of the team, we just spitball it, we improve it. Mm-hmm. They say no to me sometimes, which is frustrating, but that's what, you know, it's probably the right decision. And it's for the best of the company, which is great. I've got a really good business partner. He's a very private person, so I'm not going to talk a lot about him, but he's very experienced. He's been there, done it, got the T-shirt. He's a lot older than me, so he's lived through lots of recessions. But he's good as a sounding board. So he's effectively our chairman, but my business partner as well. And, you know, he's like, his words, he's the wily old man that gives the benefit of his years of wisdom.
Right. So you don't class yourself as a wily old man as yet, then, John?
What, with this amazing hair and youthful skin? Definitely not.
Very good. And John, it's been an absolute pleasure. So I'm Will Mellor. This is My Property World podcast. John Paul, thank you. Check him out on Instagram. What was that? The handle again?
Yeah, John Paul Mentor.
John Paul Mentor, no hyphens or anything. No,
just put John Paul Mentor and it'll come up.
Okay, and that's John with a H.
It is, yeah, G-O-H-N.
John Paul Mentor, that's fantastic. So thanks again, and we'll get you back on for another one.
Cheers, thanks Will, thanks for having me.
Welcome to My Property World, a light and informative look at all things property. We have designed this series for people involved in property and property finance in the UK market. However, we do take examples from all around the property world. Our aim is for us to make money from property together, whether that be buying, selling, financing, trading, or getting involved in a deal in another way. We do this by informing, entertaining, and enjoying ourselves talking property, which gives you a chance to get to know us, what we're up to, and to check us out until you're ready to make money together. In the meantime, My Property World is free and fun, so plug in your headphones and enjoy. We would love for you to like, share, and comment, so please do on social media. And if you have questions, ideas for topics, or deals you would like to explore, we're always looking for guests, so get in touch via the My Property World profile.